I remember when I was in seminary, and it was this interesting season where we kind of peeked off into the horizon to kind of picture what our life might be like, and we found ourselves in the class, like the practical pastoral class about weddings and funerals and that sort of thing, and the professor there was a guy named Scott Winnig, and was very, very, very helpful and good. And so we had all these young guys, and we were scared what that first wedding and that first funeral was going to look like. And he said, here's what you should do on your first wedding. He says, you're going to be scared to death. Just don't tell anybody. And then at the rehearsal, stand up there and just fake it. Just act really confident. Just be really confident, and it'll go all right. I remember the first wedding I did, I looked like I was 12. I was nervous, and I remember I did that. I just, it's okay, so we're gonna do this now, and by golly, you gain a little confidence and a little competence along the way. And I've done a few weddings since then, and what has changed is I've gotten more confident naturally and more competent, we hope. But what hasn't changed is the joy of a wedding and the beauty of a wedding. And the great joy, from my perspective, to get to be here and stand here as two people look at each other with love and hope and promise their life and their love to one another. The joy in that moment hasn't changed, hasn't faded over the years and all the weddings since then. Well, Jesus is going to use that picture and that reminder of the joy of a wedding as the Pharisees ask him a question. So we pick it up in Mark chapter 2, verse 18. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And people came and said to him, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? So, just a reminder, to fast is to give up something. Typically, you would give up food, often drink, for a period of time, maybe 24 hours. Could be longer, could be shorter. But you fast as a spiritual discipline, often as a declaration of mourning or of grief. It's actually only mandated one time in the Old Testament, and that is the Day of Atonement, found in Leviticus chapter 16. But as a spiritual discipline, it's done often. But it's done to grieve. It's done to mourn, or it's done as a powerful way to connect with God. Here's the difference, though. It's not to earn holy points or earn brownie points with God, but it is a powerful way to kind of grab a hold of your mind and focus your attention on him. Health-wise, people have now found that there's quite good health benefits from fasting, and so there's a whole niche health world that talks about the benefits of fasting. So the disciples of John the Baptist would fast. The Pharisees and their people would fast. So they come to Jesus and say, hey, how come these people fast, and how come those people fast, but you, who claim to be the Son of Man, who claim to have authority, who claim to be, in many ways, extra righteous, and he was, if all those things are true, how come your people don't do what those disciples do? How come your people don't fast? After all, they're fasting and your people don't. Verse 19, and here's his response. Jesus said to them, can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. You ever been to a wedding in which you grieved? You'll remember it. Maybe you never have. Have you ever been to a wedding and you're like, this isn't good. She's marrying not a blessing, but a curse. He's marrying not a blessing, but a curse. If that happens, you remember it. You know why? Because weddings are supposed to be joy-filled events. To mourn and to fast at a wedding wouldn't be normal, and under normal circumstances wouldn't be appropriate. Think about how wild that would be if someone said, hey, let's have a toast. And you're like, no, actually, I'm grieving. Were you grieving what? I'm grieving the wedding. What? No, we're here to celebrate. So Jesus takes that picture that they knew to be true, that at a wedding is a day of celebration, and that we know to be true. A wedding with all things normal, all things healthy, is a day to celebrate. He knows that, we know that, and he takes that truth and he leverages it like this. You wouldn't grieve in the presence of the bride or the groom. My disciples aren't grieving because I am here. But there's going to come a day when the bridegroom is taken from them, and then they will fast in that day. So Jesus is saying, it's not appropriate to fast now because the bridegroom is here. He's walking with them. He's present with them. This is the time to celebrate. Grieving comes when we long for Jesus to come, or in our case, we long for Jesus to come again. So now we could fast and we could grieve. In fact, in the last few weeks, as a country, we have grieved. We have mourned. And we have said things like, oh, come, Lord Jesus. How long, oh Lord? We see and we feel the wickedness around us. How long? And hearts are heavy and people fast, and that's good and appropriate because we wait and we long for Jesus to return. But in this moment, he says, no, they don't fast now because I'm with them. In fact, as he's coming, he's changing things. Next, he's going to move on in the same argument. It's kind of like, now that I've got your attention, I'm going to remind you that we celebrate that he's here. We don't mourn. And then, oh, well, I got your attention. Let me remind you of a couple other things. He's going to give two illustrations here. Verse 21. No one sews a piece of unshrunk clothes on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine in old wineskins, for if he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But the new wine is for fresh wineskins. So Jesus takes this opportunity to do a little more teaching, and he uses two illustrations that would have been perfectly understood by them, and then he uses those to make his point. The first one is this: you can't sew on a piece of clothing or a patch on an old garment when that patch is brand new. Now, in our world in which everything is so manufactured, so out of sight, out of mind, sometimes it's hard for us to even like put ourselves there. But as they made homemade clothes and fabrics, right, the fabric would come up and then it would shrink as it was washed. Obviously, he's saying you can't put a big patch on a piece of clothing and then sew it up, and then that patch shrinks and it pulls away from the stitches. Now you've caused more damage. You haven't fixed things. We get that. They would have known that right away. That's his first picture. The second picture is this with wineskins. So wineskins were used from the hides of animals. They certainly had clay pots and things of that nature, but they had a lot of animal skins. They would take an animal hide. I wasn't there, but what I read, is they loved to use the animal legs, and they could fasten up the end of the leg, take that same hide, which is now kind of naturally made a little bit of a container, sewed up the seams, and then you'd put wine in there, and that fermenting process that makes the wine would stretch the wineskins. That's great, but what you couldn't do is you couldn't take wineskins, hide that had been stretched out and left out in the sun, that was frail and brittle, that had lost all of its ability to stretch. You couldn't put new wine into that because as it fermented, it would stretch and expand and it would rip the wineskins. So he says, you can't mix the two. Now, we get the picture. You got to have a patch that's been stretched and shrunken. You can't put wine that's going to ferment and all of that in a container that can't stretch. But the question is, like, that's fine, but what does it mean for us? What is he saying with these two illustrations? It's one that Jesus brings joy, not emptiness, is what he's saying with the fasting. Like his presence brings us joy, and that joy should be celebrated. And then he carries that on to these next sections to remind us that Jesus brings new life, not old religion that's been polished up. Jesus didn't come to just do business as usual. He didn't come to refine a system that was already in place. Jesus came so that they would have new life, and he's consistent in that. Oh, in John 3, he says, you must be born again. And Nicodemus is like, huh? No, you must be born again. And Nicodemus is like, how can that be? How can you enter your mother's womb for a second time? And Jesus says, don't you understand? You must be born again. Jesus didn't come to take an old system and polish it up, refine it. He came to bring us new life and new hearts, just as Ezekiel said that he would. He didn't come to tweak religious traditions. He was coming to bring something entirely new. To his listeners, this would have been powerful, maybe even shocking. As Jesus was explaining that the old covenant was giving way and the new covenant was coming, that true discipleship meant embracing the new way of Jesus and not clinging to old rituals for security. What Jesus is reminding them is that he didn't just come to be another way to connect with God. He came as the way to be with God. Do you feel that difference? Jesus didn't come just so we could patch Jesus onto our current way of life and go on with life better that way because we put on this new Jesus way of life. We couldn't pour in some new thing, this new Jesus, into the old container of life and expect that to work well. He says it doesn't work like that at all. If we're not careful, we'll do the same thing. We have no intention of repenting from a life of sin. We have no desire to turn from our former ways and turn to Christ and ask him to fill us and renew us and make us new again. If we're not careful, we'll be like, yeah, all right, this Jesus thing, I'll add him to my life to make my life better. It'll be a nice little addition. You know, we hear that so often as our missionaries serve in places where Hinduism is so prevalent. Their challenge is not getting people to believe that Jesus is God. Their challenge is getting them to believe that Jesus is the only God. That Jesus is the only way. That you can't mix a old patch and a new patch. That Jesus is the only way. He's reminding them and he's reminding us that he has come to bring a new way. He's reminding them that his grace is going to be enough for us. In fact, if you're a note keeper, number one, it's going to come up on your screen. The grace of Jesus is enough. We don't have to add the grace of Jesus to the old system and put them together and we're twice as good. No. We get to rest that the grace of Jesus is enough. often will receive the grace, but we'll want to keep the religion. We'll want to keep the rules. We want to keep the rituals that we have made up to applaud ourselves. We want grace, but we also want to keep score. We want to compare our righteousness with other people. We want to remember our good deeds and forget our failures. But Jesus comes and he says, I'm not an addition to your religion. I'm a new reality that brings joy and brings life. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament before them. It's a big difference for us. So when we find ourselves wanting to cling to things that we put our trust in, remember that the grace of Jesus is enough. We don't have to add him to our life. He becomes our life. Now, rituals and things can help remind us of the truth. That's great. But we don't use those as a way to gain merit or grace from God. The grace of Jesus is enough. So the section goes on, and it says, one Sabbath day, he was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, it's him and his people, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. And the Pharisees were looking to him, look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath? So let's talk a little about the Sabbath. This is a big section today. We've talked about their being perturbed that he's not fasting the way that they think that he should fast. Now they're going to be frustrated because they don't think that he's keeping the Sabbath in the way that he should keep the Sabbath. Now, just so we're all clear on the Sabbath is the day of rest. It goes all the way back to creation where God created all on 6 days and took the seventh day to rest. The Sabbath was a big deal to the Jewish people, a legitimate big deal. It's one of the Ten Commandments given to Israel. It was one of the defining marks of their identity. Sabbath was from sunset on Friday to sunset on Saturday. All were to stop work. The rich, the poor, the young, the old, everybody stopped working to rest. The Sabbath was given for them as a gift. As a gift for them to rest. For God knew that it wasn't good for them to work every day and toil 7 days, which I think is interesting that all these years later, we still think the same thing. We still think it's not good to work 24/7. We still think that rest is important if you're a believer or whether you're not a believer. Most people, I think all people, recognize that we've got to rest. So God gave them this gift of the Sabbath, commanded them to follow it. But humans are legalistic by nature. And so as soon as we have a rule, we ask follow-up questions. Well, if I'm supposed to rest, what is rest? If I'm not supposed to work, well, what would you define as work? How far can I still work and get away with it? And how little can I rest and still get away with it? Now, I know your kids are all perfect, but sometimes kids will even do that and they'll push the thing and they'll say, how far, how close can I get? When you say that I can't, did you mean I really can't or maybe that I shouldn't? So what happened was, teachers and rabbis came up with additional clarifications and rules outside the Bible, which the Bible was quite strict on the Sabbath. But the rabbis, the leaders, came up with additional rules. Their rules became known as the Melakot, which is literally in Hebrew means build a fence. So this is our holy day. You can't work, you must rest. And in order that we don't violate that, they built a fence of rules around it. And the rules then became difficult and somewhat arbitrary. Things like they couldn't write more than one letter or sew more than one stitch. You couldn't repair a fallen roof. You couldn't carry an entire orange in your pocket, but a half would be okay. You could only take so many steps on the Sabbath. You couldn't tie a knot, but women could tie girdles. If there was a tragedy, you could see if there was someone in need to be recovered, like if a building fell on somebody, and you could bring them out, but if they were deceased, you had to wait till the next day to remove them. Jewish people today still keep the Sabbath quite strictly. In fact, one of the defining characteristics of Orthodox Judaism today is a strict keeping of the Sabbath. Still with rules of melakot, of fencing around the Sabbath. I once worked close to a Jewish or an Orthodox Jewish community. And I would see their big flowing beards. I worked on Saturday, their Sabbath. And they would push their strollers with their families and their kids to the synagogue because they did not drive on Saturdays. That was their Sabbath. They still want to keep it. But what's interesting for the people in this day was the rules had become so exhausting, so difficult, so burdensome that this gift of rest had become a burden to bear. What could we do? What can we not do? There's great irony here that it was supposed to rest, and now they're looking over the shoulder. Can we do this? Can we not do this? Can we do this? Can we not do this? Do you see how legalism takes something that's supposed to be good and complicates it into something that we've got to achieve and we've got to do and we've got to complete? The Sabbath was given to be a gift. Not a test to be completed. Not a checklist of things. Well, did you do this? Did you not do this? Did you get some grain on the Sabbath? Did you do this? It was given to us that we could rest and turn our hearts back to God. So what was happening was the disciples and Jesus were walking alongside these fields and they're hungry. And so they would reach over and they would pluck off grains or heads of grain so that they could eat them. This is important because the Old Testament is strict on what is allowed and permissible on the Sabbath. This, specifically, is allowed. You're allowed when you're hungry to walk along a field and break off a little bit of seeds to eat. That was perfectly allowed. What you weren't allowed to do is you couldn't take a sickle out on the Sabbath and harvest on the Sabbath. So to be clear, what they're doing is perfectly okay, but offensive to the Pharisees who had such a strict understanding of the Sabbath. So they come to Jesus and say, how come you guys are doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? His response, which I think is really boss. Verse 25. Have you never read? Okay. This is easy to miss. These are the Pharisees. These are the religious leaders of the day that would have known the law the best, would have known the Old Testament scriptures the best. These are the guys that everyone knew. If you had a question about the Bible, go to them. You have a question about what it says, go to them. His response, he starts off with, he says, have you never read? Like, do you get how offensive that would be to people who have so much of their self-righteousness tied up in their ability to know the word? They got so much of their own pride and arrogance tied up in their knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, and his response starts with, have you ever even read it? Have you opened it up? Have you looked at it? Have you unrolled a scroll lately? Remember, Jesus, throughout his ministry, has tremendous compassion on those who are humble and meek, and he's quite strong with those who are proud and arrogant. So has that you ever read? Do you remember the story of David? Now, to any good Jewish person, you say the word David, and they're like, oh, wait, King David? Well, we know all about King David. We love King David, and they should. When he was in need and he was hungry, both David and those who were with him, they entered into the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and they ate the bread of the presence. This is Jesus speaking now, which is not lawful for any but the high priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. So Jesus says, have you not read? Do you remember the story when David and his guys were fleeing from Saul? They were fleeing, they were homeless, they were on the run, and they were starving. And they came into the temple. Now there's a place inside the temple, the Holies of Holies, and you had to be a Levitical priest to enter into that. A king didn't count. In fact, if you want to read a really harrowing account of that, read about King Uzziah, who basically decided, I'm priest enough, I'm the king. And he goes in and violates the inner courts and his leprosy casts off, and that's how his life ended poorly. So Jesus brings up this interesting story. He says, you remember when they were walking and they were desperate and they were hungry? And there was this bread that had been consecrated as a holy offering. That's the only bread they could find. And David and his men went and they ate the bread. But David was not a priest. David didn't have any right to be in there. This is not the Pharisees telling Jesus what's not lawful. This is Jesus reminding the Pharisees what's not lawful. He says, you remember? They went in there. They ate because they had to, because they needed to. Theologians have wrestled with this text. What does this mean for us? Does it mean we get to pick and choose? No, Jesus is using this picture to remind us of a higher value, of a higher priority. That they're starving and you're so hung up on the rules that you are going to allow someone to starve because there's bread there, but they're not worthy to eat it. Verse 27, he says to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. You know what I think Jesus is doing here? He's putting humanity on the law. He's helping them to see, no, David went someplace he wasn't supposed to be, and he ate because he had to. Because those laws were here for us, to help us. But humanity's above those. I've come to serve humanity. So he says, in light of that story, I want us to remind us about the Sabbath, that the Sabbath was made for man, not made for the Sabbath. What does that mean? That means this, that the Sabbath was a gift for us, not a burden for us to bear. It was designed for us to find rest and to rejuvenate. We don't serve the Sabbath. The Sabbath serves us. I was in the middle of a workout the other day, and a long-term buddy called. We've been playing phone tag for a long time, and I knew he had just a short window to talk if he had called. And I'm like right in the middle of this workout, and there's part of me that's like, I'll call him later, because I don't want to stop this and finish. I got to finish this. I have more rounds to go for this workout to be complete. And I know myself, because I'd read this all week, I thought, how foolish. The workout serves me. I don't serve the workout. I stopped, caught my breath, and answered the phone. I had a wonderful talk. Jesus says the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This was quite shocking for them. So much of their identity had been wrapped up in keeping the Sabbath as perfectly and as accurately as possible. Now he's saying, you know what? I have come to fulfill the Sabbath. I have come so that we can find rest in him. He's not saying that the Sabbath was bad. He's saying he's come to fulfill the Sabbath. Hebrews 4 reminds us that we find our hope and rest in Jesus. So then he ends in verse 28, the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. So if you're a note taker, point number two is going to come up on your screen. It says, Jesus has the authority over the Sabbath. This is a big deal. He continues to show his authority over sickness, over disease, over nature, over people. Now he's showing he has the authority even over the Sabbath. And that changes how we live as Christians. Now, sometimes it's easy for us to think that what we did was we took the Jewish Sabbath on Saturday and we moved it to Sunday. It's easy for us to think that we took the Jewish Saturday and we made it the Christian Sunday. Okay. In some ways, I can see how we would think that we gather on Sundays to worship, just as the early church did from the very beginning to celebrate and worship on the day of his resurrection. Sunday became known as the Lord's Day. But we don't keep Sunday as the Sabbath. We find it good to rest, to worship on Sundays. But we ultimately find our rest in Christ, in Jesus. And so we don't have to keep some day perfectly accurate in hopes that Jesus is going to love us enough. Even when we look back here, it's the grace of Jesus is enough. We don't have to keep some day perfectly and some rules perfectly. We don't raise a pen, or we don't sew one too many stitches, or we don't have one too many things, or work, take one too many steps. The grace of Jesus is enough for us. Don't just patch Jesus into our life, but no, allow him to change our life, because he has the authority not just over sickness and in death, but over the Sabbath. And he says and invites us in, come to me, all who are heavy laden, all who are weary. Jesus invites us not into a system, but into a relationship with him. So we find our rest in him. When we're anxious, we are reminded that he holds our future. When we're uncertain that we're loved, we're reminded that he loved us at our worst, and nothing can separate us from the love of God. Friends, that helps us to find our rest in him.